the chest will go up a little bit, or you'll feel the air coming to your tummy, anything like that. Just try and feel the breath anywhere in the body. And wherever, whenever a thought comes into your mind, just gently put it aside by returning your awareness back to your breath. So we're just going to do this for 5 minutes, and the point of doing it is just to sort of, one is to be present, and the other is just to allow the body and the mind to sort of calm down. So just get comfortable in your seat, try to make sure your back is straight and your shoulders relaxed. And you can either keep your eyes open or close them. You might begin by just taking a deep breath in through your nostrils, just breathing in through the nose. Then forcefully exhaling through the mouth. Go. And one more. And then just allow yourself to breathe normally and naturally. If you hear something different and it distracts you, just notice it, relax a little more, and come back to the breath and breathe normally and naturally. So your awareness is becoming more stable and the body is becoming more relaxed. And as the body relaxes, the mind relaxes. You feel more present. And feeling relaxed, it's very easy to be present. It's very easy to imagine that you are sitting amidst a vast crowd of people, and that above your head appears a great number of enlightened beings. They understand everything that needs to be known. They have great wisdom, and great compassion, and great skill with working with us and the people who surround us. So if you can imagine that you're in the presence of all living beings and all of the enlightened beings, I wonder what sort of purpose you would give for being there. So you are here for a reason. You have reasons for being here. What I would like you to do is to add to those original reasons a wish to develop greater compassion, greater wisdom, and a greater ability to work skillfully with yourself and other living beings. And then, having that intention, I want you to breathe in deeply through your nostrils and exhale through your mouth, and allow your eyes to flutter open. And on the screen up there, there is a prayer, and we're going to just recite it together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And in response to this wish and prayer, from the bodies of these enlightened beings that are above us, rays of light and nectar pour forth and they wash over us and over all the beings surrounding us. And we find that we have these four qualities of immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable joy, and immeasurable equanimity. And being in front of this vast field of merit, these enlightened beings, we say, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. And now, just in case there's any sort of clinging to this imaginary field, any sort of sense that it truly exists, we're going to imagine that our body and all the ideas that we have sort of vanish and then reappear as a wonderful and beautiful universe where all beings can take teachings from enlightened beings. And we call this a mandala. And we're going to offer this to all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, the enlightened beings, which are above us. So again, reciting, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Iyam Gururata Manda Kamayata Yahami. So I've released the offering, and the leader of all these enlightened beings called the Buddha, he accepts it and he looks down at us and smiles with delight at us. And we look up into his eyes and we feel accepted and at ease. And then an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart and moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head. It's facing in the same direction you are. And then it descends and enters the crown of your head and comes down to the level of your heart. And its radiant body begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light. And the light goes out through the pores of your skin and begins to fill the 10 directions of space. And you find that yourself and all the beings around you have all sort of vanished into this light. And the idea of a self or an I and an other, the idea that there is an inner and an outer, have vanished. And you just rest in the light. And then the light begins to withdraw from the 10 directions of space, goes back to your heart, and you find yourself sitting on your chair, breathing normally and naturally. And you understand that this meditation has been purely on the level of imagination. It's also imprinted the mind so that this can become a cause for its effect. And again, you breathe in deeply through your nostrils. You exhale through your mouth. Your eyes are closed, you open them. And now you just move your body, move your hands, your feet, whatever you need to feel quite relaxed, to be at ease in your seat. So, hello again, and welcome to this Discovering Buddhism course called Refuge in the Three Jewels. So, it's 9 weeks in total. We've actually got 8 classes, and there's a review class, so it'd be total 9. There's also a special event on the 16th of April, where we actually have a refuge ceremony. So the idea behind that is if people wish to take refuge, you have some knowledge of what it means to be a Buddhist, what it means to take refuge. So it's, you're not doing it blindly. You've got some idea of what you're doing. And it'll be taking place. We'll have the Geshe Sultran will come down from Chan Rusik Institute, and he'll sort of sit here like this, and he'll give you a teaching on refuge. And if you've been here doing this course, you'll know everything he's talking about. Plus, he'll give you a bit more too. And then finally, he'll ask you whether you would like to become a Buddhist. And if you say yes, then he'll say that we'll engage in this refuge ceremony, and then after it, you'll be a Buddhist practitioner. And then the work will begin. So we're going to be talking about, over this course, the causes for seeking refuge, the objects of refuge, what it means to go for refuge, and what you do after taking refuge.
I'll just jump in here too and say that it's quite rare that we have the refuge ceremony and have a course beforehand with such in-depth teachings. So it's really nice that it's come along in this order. At the same time, don't feel that you have to come to the refuge ceremony, you have to take refuge, but at least this way you'll be able to make a very informed decision rather than just kind of jump in the deep end.
So to present this course and sort of point out maybe some helpful books for you. These are some of the readings that I've been relying upon. So here, those first three books, they have come out of teachings by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and a nun called Venerable Thupten Chodron. And there are sort of 7 of them so far in the series, and there's about another 3 to come, I think. So why I particularly like them, they were particularly constructive or made up for Westerners in particular. And this came with conversations between Venerable Thupten Chodron and the Dalai Lama. So she was saying, oh, for many of the Westerners, we get involved in teachings of the Buddha, come to centers like this, but there's not much material for us. And so out of that discussion came this whole, what they call it, a library. And it's for Westerners who've been educated, and it's easy to read. However, many of the concepts might be a bit new to us. And so it's in depth, it's wide because it covers the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, it covers the Pali tradition, and it also covers the Zen tradition. The next book called Lamrim Year is a very interesting book. It's got 365 meditations in there. And so in there's a section on the meditations you can do to help yourself more deeply understand and comprehend refuge. In fact, any Dharma topic. And lastly, the book is called Steps on the Path to Enlightenment by Geshe Sopa. For each step on the path to enlightenment, there's a subject. And in that book, the subject of refuge is there, of course. Again, it's explained in such a way that it's easy to comprehend for us. If you've gone to school, you've got a decent enough education, you can read that material and go, okay, I understand. Now today, we're going to sort of address 8 questions that are asked at the end of this module. And I've sort of put them into these four subject areas. The first is, what are the ordinary sources of refuge? What does it mean to take refuge as a Buddhist? And what are the causes for doing that? And so I want to sort of explain refuge from that point. So at the end of this, it'll be like, this is what it means if you have declared, if you want to be a Buddhist refugee. So some of the questions involved in these four points, I'll just mention a couple, I find them quite interesting. It says, if a Christian friend of yours wants to know what taking refuge means and why you want to do it, what could you say? So at the end of this course, you should be able to say, well, this is why I'm a Buddhist. Another one says, do you think taking refuge will change your life? And if it did, how would it do so? And the third interesting question that Lama Yeshe, one of the founders of this organization, asks is, we as Westerners should understand that taking refuge is a state of mind. What does that mean? Now, these are some of the questions that will come up, and I'll try and answer them. Now, the other thing is, so if you are taking notes here, so this is just a suggestion that I've found very useful and helpful for me when I take notes. So please don't copy everything I say or try and get everything. For your notes, it can be quite effective and useful for you. Just ask these sort of three questions. What's really interesting about what he just said? So that's the first thing, what's interesting? The next one is, you ask and say, well, it's interesting because it's similar to something or it's so unlike something. And this is important to me because. So these are three things. Well, that was interesting, so you take the note. Right? Then the thing is, well, why? Why is it interesting to me? And why is it important? You know, just an idea, because I'm going to ask you some questions just like that as we go through these slides. So let's have a look at refuge first of all, and in particular, refuge in other languages. So as you know, there are different forms of Buddhism. One is called the Pali, sort of the original Buddhism, mainly focused in Sri Lanka now. So in that language, it's called Saranam. In Sanskrit, it's called Sarana, so you can see it's not much difference there. And in Tibetan, it's Kyab Dro, or Kyab Su Dro. But each of them basically means, in English, I go for refuge. And in the Pali, this term, the Saranam, means like a house. There's another term for it, it's a house or shelter. So you're sort of saying, I'm going to seek shelter. Sanskrit basically means the same. And in Tibetan, it means protection. So a house does give you protection from the elements. The other term means it's relief. So I seek relief. I'm going to seek relief or protection or shelter. This is what this term sort of means. And in Tibetan, this Kyab Dro is associated with protection and hope. Often they call it like a medicine that will cure your ills, different things that plague you. Another way of looking at it is like, it's like reaching out for a helping hand. And to know refuge is to realize that there is something about you that is better than the ordinary or petty concerns that you have about ordinary things. There's a sense of relief that you can find from that. So one of the teachers called Pema Khadro, she said, to know refuge is to realize there is a way of being which is beyond convoluted logic, darkness, hatred, or any type of trauma. And basically this is what makes a person become a Buddhist, to seek that, to seek freedom, a sense of release, a sense of protection from what is problematic for us. So refuge has a number of different synonyms. So, as you know, as I said, people seek refuge, don't they? You know, people come from a foreign country seeking different difficult political situations, wars. They get on boats, they flee, they look for refuge, they seek cover and asylum. And basically, as a Buddhist, that's what you're doing too. You're not running away from the world, you're running away from your afflicted mind, in a way, moving away from it, moving away from the causes of it. So you seek a sense of protection. So a sense of safety and shelter. So just up the road here, we have a place called the Zigzag Home for
Women's Shelter.
So of course, so these women are seeking shelter from, I'd imagine mostly would be an abusive relationship. So what you do is you flee the relationship and you find a place where you're safe. And that's, if you look at that, so that's from the way you're living, I guess, the outside world. What a Buddhist is doing is that they are seeing that they are also being abused. And what they're being abused by is their own uncontrollable mental states. And they seek shelter and freedom from that. So being in another house or being anywhere, actually, that's not going to provide you shelter, right? Because wherever you go, your mind goes with you. So the shelter has to be like mind itself. So the mind will create all your difficulties, but the mind has to also provide the freedom from the difficulties. And the Buddhist is recognizing that. That's why you take refuge as a Buddhist, to go, man, all the problems actually are primarily my own. And they're all mental. And so I want to do something about that. Now I want to seek freedom from that, shelter from that. So well, the only way you can do that is with your own mind. You'll have to create your own shelter. And you say, well, that's what I'll do. That's my responsibility. I'll do it. No one can do it for me. Now we've been doing this for a long, long time already. And so I want to show you some of the more common refuges that we've had throughout our lives. And this slide here, so while I'm showing the information and talking, I want you to sort of think, what's interesting about this? Is there anything interesting about this material? And if it is, what is it? What's interesting about it? And why is that important? So just sort of keep that in the background. As we're finished, we'll look at it, and I'll sort of ask if some of you could say, well, this is what I find interesting, okay? So please don't freak out, Deb, get ready. I might ask you. Okay, here we go. So more common refuges. The most common one, of course, is your mother, because when you're born, you definitely need someone to help you, and it's really always your mother. And if you don't have a mother, as we know, man, it really messes children up. So parents are our first natural refuge. Then the family you find yourself in. If you're married, it's often your spouse. If you're in a relationship, it's often your partner. And many other times, it's a pet. So these are common refuges that we seek to ameliorate our suffering, make it easier for ourselves to get through life. Others are, like I said, your natural home. Everybody, don't we say we've been on holiday? It's so good to be home. Many, the country and the society, is a very common one, entertainment. So most people, they come home, they will, most people watch television or listen to music. They'll have something come in to help them get through their heavy day. My my brother and his wife, they're New Zealanders. New Zealand has a culture of heavy drinking. When they come home from work, the first thing she does is pours herself a glass of wine and sits down. My brother goes to the fridge and opens a beer. It's his refuge. One of his refuges. When we're not in good health, we often go and see doctors, or we read books on medical stuff, and we try and solve our problems. We use exercise, rely on health professionals, and probably the most common refuge of all is food. So how many times you sit there and you get bored and you just find yourself going to the fridge?
Comfort eating.
Whenever we go out, we often stop, we get a coffee, we sit down and we eat something. It's a refuge. Alcohol, sex and drugs, quite common refuges. Others are like religion and philosophy. We try and explain or deal with the problems we have in life by relying upon a religion or a philosophy. Another very common refuge for many, many people is their job. If it's not a job, then get a hobby. Politics and power. And another very, very common refuge is to have wealth, money. Now, if you notice, if you take some of those things away, you'll know how difficult your life is straight away, right? So we rely on these common phenomena to improve our lives into what we call be happy. So what's interesting about these? Deb? Well, what I hear you saying is there's not always safe protections. And that, so in other ways, we're saying, so sometimes we might go for a sense of
security,
happiness, but then if you have too much of it, suddenly you're unhappy. Or if it gets taken away from you, you're unhappy again.
Yeah,
so it's not a really sure refuge, is it?
It can work for a while. Food, alcohol, sex and drugs can work for a while, but then your health starts to deteriorate.
Yeah, it does, that's right. So we find a lot of rock musicians in particular don't have very long lives. So what else is interesting? Yeah?
Almost all of them can be taken away from
you. Yeah, this is right. Yeah, so almost all of them can be taken away from us at the back?
They're all external.
Fantastic. That's right. They're all external things. So they're all external and they're unreliable in the sense that they can be taken away from us, or actually they can produce suffering as well as happiness. So if we say that if we acknowledge that, saying that, okay, so they're unreliable, in the sense that they could be taken away from us, we can lose them, or that they don't always produce the happiness we're seeking. If you have something like too much wealth, it can be a big problem for you.
Too much of your parents.
Yeah, that's right, too much of our family. That's right. After we have holidays to get away from them, or we go towards them and then we find that's enough. Right? So, what's important about knowing that then? What do you think?
Gary here online says that they're all bound in samsara. Francesca says, she had to switch her headphones. So there you go. I think that's also everything you know about. There's always something that's not quite right.
Something not quite right. So if this knowledge became important to you, what might you do? So it's like you thought, okay, so these things are also unreliable in some sense. They're unstable. They can produce happiness, sure, but they can also produce suffering. And they're all external to me. Yeah, but you might decide, I need to, if that's the case, that all these external objects are sort of unreliable and can produce suffering as well as happiness, you know, I want to be happy. And Buddhists are talking about a refuge, perhaps it means I might have to rely upon my own inner resources. If you look at your inner resources, which are just your body and mind, so yours, It can't be the body, because bodies, you know, break down, don't they? We get sick, we get old. You only produce strength in the body, well, it's limited what you can do with the body. So this leaves the mind then. So if we're going to take refuge, this place, it's going to have to be the mind. And we do that right now too, but it doesn't provide a reliable refuge right now, does it? Even though it is actually, it could be. Whereas none of these others could be. So the source of it, this is what the Buddha's sort of putting out, all suffering comes from an undisciplined mind. And all happiness comes from the mind that has been disciplined. So if we can discipline the mind, that's our refuge. Now, just to follow along from the common refuges, so even if you decide, oh, that's what I'm going to do, right? I'm going to become a Buddhist, an inner being, and take refuge in my own inner good qualities, which I'm going to develop, and they'll be mental. So even though you decide to do that, there's going to be a lot working against you. The major things that will work against you are the habits you've already built up, the habits to look out into the world to find the sources of happiness. That's the major one. And when we look out into the world to find ways to be happy and engage with these more common objects, it's not the objects that are the problem, right? It's not our parents, family, all these things. That's not really the problem. It's how the mind engages with them. And when the mind engages with them in these two methods, two means I'm going to show you shortly, then it's problematic for us. Two means that are problematic is, one, we overestimate the qualities of these objects here. Or we underestimate them. So these are the two things. So when we underestimate, we have aversion towards them. And when we overestimate them, we have attachment towards them. And so we can divide all this list up into what they call the eight worldly concerns. So we take everything and just break it up into two groups. Objects that we have aversion towards and objects that we have attachment towards. So attachment is not just that we like them, that we overestimate them.
That kind of explains why we can have both attachment and aversion to many of these things.
Yeah, so you find that, don't you? So most people, before they get married, they say, as they like the person, don't they? I mean, I don't think many people get married when they dislike somebody. Sometimes people are forced into that. But normally speaking, if you like them, it goes from like and then it goes to love. And that liking and that loving is mixed with attachment. So you overestimate the person that you want to have the relationship with. And when that overestimation is proven wrong, you don't think, oh, that was my mistake. You think, it was my partner's mistake, right? And then that leads to all the divorces that we know that are quite common, right? So here, let's have a look at these, what they call the eight worldly concerns. So in terms of seeking delight, we've got four things, and avoiding displeasure, aversion, we have four. So the first is called seeking delight, or having attachment to anything that is pleasurable. So this is comfort, and basically like anything you think is nice. And what we want to do is to avoid anything that is uncomfortable, unpleasant, painful. So we have an aversion towards pain. Now, oftentimes when you think of pain, the first thing that arises naturally to me right now, and everyone just said it, is that I don't like it. So it's like, it's negative. But is it? It's not, is it? It's not completely all bad. We need pain. Pain is very useful to us. So to have aversion to it, that's where I've gone, I've overestimated pain. Because actually pain's a warning system for the body and mind, isn't it? In fact, was that thing we saw about that person who had no feeling of pain? So a few people in the world have been born with this condition. They don't feel pain. But that's not a good thing. Did you get these stories?
It's a nightmare for their parents, trying to keep them safe and not put their hands in the hot water or the flame.
Oh, and then as you get older, you bump yourself and you get these bruises and you don't even know. And then they get infected. And next thing, you're heading closer off to death. But it seems like a natural thing that we should avoid all pain, isn't it? Pain's bad. And it seems like a natural thing that comfort is good for us. And all the nice things are really good for us. We should only have them. But many times it's brought the downfall of empires, comfort. So this is what we're trying to... And so, like, now again, the problem is not in the chocolate cakes that we like, or the couches that we like to lie on, or the television programs. That's not it. It's the attachment, the overestimation. And that's coming from our mind. That's not the object. It's our mind that's doing that. And it does it naturally. We can't sort of stop it. We don't even, most times we don't even know what's going on. And so, you know, like I said, so sometimes we, you know, we start off the relationship, we have affection, but it's mixed with attachment. When our object of affection changes in some way, immediately what we call love turns into aversion, and then anger, then even hatred. And that's the problem with this overestimation or underestimation. We don't see objects clearly. The other thing was that, you know, we really have attachment towards getting things. A lot of times it's like our own way. This is one of the things we have the biggest attachment to, right? Our own way. We always want to make a profit. We like acquiring things. But as you said, what's that program we watch sometimes? Oh,
the
about
hoarders.
The hoarders. Oh.
Or even just like how we have to declutter all the time. Right. And it's always a surprise, like again.
So in terms of acquiring things, so today, you know, like I've got a lot of material, Dharma material. I opened up my drawer today to put it in and it's so full. I was kind of, oh my God, I'll have to take all this out and start taking it out and throwing, not throwing it away, but we've got to get rid of it. So I've acquired all this material over time. And of course then we have this aversion to loss or deterioration. We have attachment to praise, to being admired. We want to be approved, and we do not want to be blamed, criticized, or abused. So is criticism necessarily bad? So we always have none. But no, sometimes it's very useful. So again, if we overestimate it and have aversion to it, it's our loss. And if we overestimate it again and think, well, actually, I just want to be praised, that's a problem too. It doesn't help much. And the final one is what they call success. So her fame, status, reputation. This is highly encouraged in our society. And, you know, it's just, don't be an insignificant person. But there are a lot of advantages to being insignificant. And there are a lot of disadvantages to become infamous. In fact, many people who are famous wish they weren't. It's only the people who aren't famous wish they were. But and as you look at this, you think, well, this is where lots of people are taking their refuge in. And like I said, and this is what's going to be problematic for us. Even if we want to take an internal refuge, still, we'll always find ourselves drawn out in some way for these things. So and that goes on for quite a long time. And it requires a lot of intelligence to work against it and meditation. So like I said, the habit has been to go this way. That really consensus is our habit.
Because, Eddie, when I was doing my first formal study, I took that whole approach to the Dharma and wanted to get like top marks on my exam, and you know, and that became this real preoccupation of mine instead of actually, is it changing my life or changing me? But it was an automatic thing that just came along.
Yeah. And this is also not uncommon, is it? Because we know a number of different students that as soon as the geshis or the teachers say we're going to do an exam, it's like, whoa, natural aversion. Why? Because I won't be real good at it. I won't be the top. I'll make mistakes. You know, and you get these fears and so forth. So these things pop up very quickly, these eight worldly concerns. And you see, it's all focused on me. So it's a strong sense of I. And out of that has come the aversion to one side and the attachment to the other side. Now the Buddha has, there's a quote that I'm going to show you very shortly. Says a very interesting thing about this, and it's a helpful approach. So the Buddha says, the wise and mindful person knows them, meaning those eight worldly concerns, and sees that they are subject to change. That being the case, desirable conditions don't excite his mind, nor is he repelled by undesirable conditions. And so this is just to the knowledge that's sort of been deeply ingrained in him, and what we want to do ourselves as Buddhist practitioners is to become really deeply familiar with change. But those four things that we want to be, you know, want, and four things we don't want, are themselves subject to change. Not only are they subject to change, our own mind changes. So, you know, growing up as a kid, you know, I love music, and I bought a lot of it. And when I talk to other people who love music, I talk about, you know, did you hear this? Did you hear that? So I grew up in the 70s, and there's a lot of different songs that we all like, you know. So I have this idea that they're really good songs. So I think they're good, I'll go and play them again. And I play them again, and it's like, what's that song is not as good as I thought it was.
When you were 20.
Yeah, well, 14, 15, you know. I think the song's not so good now. But it's not the song, is it? The song's the same song. It's like either a piece of digital stuff or it's a record. And yeah, those changes have been very subtle, but it's not like there's been a drastic change in the record or anything. It's just my mind has changed. So the objects change and we change. So if you know that and get it embedded deeply in you by reflecting on this, using the idea of change and impermanence, then there's not so much attachment and there's not so much aversion. And you'll understand, okay, it's not so much the objects, it's me. It's my mind. You know, and it's just doing its own thing. I haven't exerted any control of it, over it, by familiarizing myself with the knowledge of impermanence and change. Yeah, the other thing I remember, so many years ago, as a Buddhist, you can make these different vows, you make promises and pledges, and one of them is to give up alcohol. And so I did that, and this day come out, and if you know, I went off to this nightclub to listen to a singer who'd been promoted by a friend of ours. And we went around, and there was a beer there. I said, I'm just going to try and see what this beer's like, you know. So I took it and I did the first sip. I was like, oh, I remember. Yeah, that was good. And I put it down and I had it again. It was like, oh, I didn't like it. Remember the time we went out with Pearlie and Jordan? We went down to the Gold Coast.
Yeah, we had a night. It was a hot day and we were just like, oh, nice cold beer. And then we waited so long in the queue. So in my mind, this, you know, the lime and the bubbles and everything. And then when we finally got it, it was disgusting.
For Miffy it was. For me it was fantastic. Right? buy that glass of beer, and it was a beer I'd never had before, and the burger. So I was like, wow, I haven't done this for years, you know. I couldn't drink the whole glass of beer, I just did a little bit of it. But I thought, it was great beer, great burger. About, I don't know, less than a year later, about 10 months later or so, I'm going through Queen Street Mall. I see that beer there. Wow, it's this Belgian beer, you know. I'll try it. I couldn't, I had one sip, that was enough. Just a waste of $8. Oh, yuck. So I'm going like, so what's different? Why is it really good and now it's not good? So I had to have a think about that. And it was like this thing you find in the text that tells you why. So anything that's good or bad depends. It depends upon not just one thing, but a whole lot of things.
Does it just depend on the beer?
No, that's right. So that's what Jordan pointed out. She said, you remember we went to the park, that big walk? Yep. Remember we had that great swim? Yep. Remember we took this walk down, how hot it was, we had to wait and everything? All of that built up this anticipation. And that, and then just seeing that, oh, that beer looked great. I can see it right now. The froth on the top and the lovely amber colour. But that didn't happen to me in the valley, in the Queen Street Mall. All those conditions were gone, we're not there. So I get a completely different result. Like the music, you know, when you're 14, it's wow. When you're in your 50s, it's like. So that's what he's saying. So the wise person remembers this. He's mindful of change and impermanence, that you yourself will be undergoing changes and the materials you engage in are also undergoing change. So you can slip from aversion to attachment and attachment to aversion. And becoming a Buddhist and taking refuge is to try to not do that. You want to find the center line where the mind becomes stable all the time. It doesn't become excited, it doesn't become depressed. It doesn't mean to say you won't enjoy your beer here if you're still drinking or enjoy music. It's not saying that. It's just you don't get overly excited or overly depressed about the things that happen to you. So what is like going for refuge then? So here, this slide here, as you can see, this is a lighthouse somewhere, and there's a fellow in the doorway, and there's this massive waves coming up, right? And it doesn't touch the person, doesn't affect the person. The person is safe. So this is like a simile or a metaphor for what it means to be a Buddhist refugee. But lots of terrible things can happen, but you're stable. The mind remains stable. It's like if it's problematic, you ask yourself, well, can you solve this problem? You go, well, yeah. Well, no problem then, is there? You say, well, I can't do anything about it. Yeah. Well, no problem, is there? You don't have to add anything to it. You're always there. You have a safety, which is your own mind. Because, like I said, the mind is the thing that determines whether you're going to be happy or unhappy, suffer or free. It's the mind. So to go for refuge means that you trust an institution or a method or a person to help you through a crisis and to deliver you to a more favorable outcome. So when we take refuge, and as a Buddhist, you take refuge in what they call the three jewels or the three rare sublime ones. These are called Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And as soon as you do, as soon as you take refuge, you're a Buddhist now. So it's called you enter the teachings of the Buddha. So when you enter this doorway or you enter the teachings, the major purpose of doing so is to bring about your own freedom, to be free from suffering and its causes. So we call that renunciation. You're putting aside whatever causes you suffering. When you do that, when that's really deeply embedded in you, and everything, you're always aware, you're always trying to do that. You've entered a path. You've entered the Buddhist paths. And if you're doing this, not just for yourself, but for everyone else, it's So now you've entered the Mahayana path. And so, you know, if you ask yourself, like, why am I doing that? Why do I want to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? Why do I want to become a Buddhist? It's because you realize that there is no happiness within samsara. So, is anybody here not familiar with this word samsara? Everyone knows what samsara is? The samsara is a sort of way of cycling. A simple way of talking about it is like having no control over your mind. So if you don't have any control over your mind, there's no way for you to be happy. So sort of recognizing that and going, damn, there's no way out. The only way is through. I'm going to have to do it. And you go, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so earlier Francisco said that, you know, currently our minds are still so unsettled, so we have all this work to do within
ourselves.
Our own mind.
Yeah. So, you know, so when we started off, so we just sort of sat and I was like, okay, so we're just going to sit down and we're just going to breathe normally and naturally. So, in a way, this is a form of taking refuge. And if you ask, like, from what? The simplest answer is from mental agitation, from thinking, from conceptuality. I just want my mind, I just want a break. And you go, okay, so the simplest way to take a break is to focus your mind on your breath. So whenever a thought comes up, realize, oh my gosh, my mind's taken off. I've lost my refuge. What was my refuge? The breath. I have to come home to the breath. So you do. And then the simplest way is to try to relax a little more, because what's actually sparing these thoughts, these conceptions, is a sense of tightness. Either the body's tight or the mind is tight. So if there's always, if you tighten up, you will be, you think. When you relax, you have a chance to drop the thinking. And so you find a refuge, a sense of calm. And then from that basis of calm, you can develop your refuge further by either going deeper with a sense of curiosity. You're looking in like, what's going on inside here? What's my mind doing? You don't ask that, you're looking. You're just looking. What sort of mind have I got? Yep. So, what's Buddhist refuge? Well, first of all, it's the entry to the Buddhist teachings. So here you're getting introduced to the Buddhist teachings, and there might be somebody here who have not taken refuge, not formally taken refuge. So what it means here is that if at the end of these 8 weeks you decide, all made sense to me, I think Buddhism might suit me, I'll become one, and you take refuge, it means now I'm actually going to start working. I've been listening, I agree, but agreement is not just going to cut it, is it? Just agreeing with things won't necessarily change my mind. It won't give me a sense of stability. So I do agree, and I'm going to have to work. I'm going to have to find some sort of method to work, change my mind, so that I gradually become more and more happier and suffer less and less. So refuge sort of establishes your spiritual direction. And what you see, this is an inward direction.
You're so working. It's like an ongoing thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not a once-off.
No. Until you're free, you haven't actually got refuge yet. You're on your way, but you're not free yet. And that's what you want, freedom. So refuge is a state of mind. And here's another quote from one of the Buddha's sutras. He says, look, the Buddhas do not wash away negativities. Negativities being suffering and its causes. With water. They don't clear away being suffering with their hands. And they don't transfer their own knowledge to others. They liberate by teaching the truth of reality. So it's, you know, it's still one of my fantasies to often sit and lie around in bed and think, oh, I wish I had the qualities of these other people. But it's never going to happen, is it? I mean, it's just a wish, but there's just no way you can download the qualities of somebody else and go, now I know all about movie production. Now I'm a great mathematician. It's never going to happen, right? Yeah, that's right. Now I know Kung Fu. But never going to happen. So all of that's dependent upon us. Well, we're going to have to do it. So here the sort of Buddha say, look, I understand any being who has an undisciplined mind will suffer, but to just hop into the Ganges River and pour water over yourself and stand in the shower and wish that I wasn't suffering, it's not going to happen. And I'm just kind of, you know, sometimes we, I know myself, we get quite frustrated. In fact, some people even hurt themselves through their own frustration. But that's not going to clear away their suffering, right? It's like being physical with yourself to get rid of your suffering. No, it doesn't work. It might give you some sort of temporary relief, but the major causes are always there. So he says, so like the Buddha, and of course I'm not a Buddha, I certainly consider myself one of his disciples, so I'm going to teach the same sort of things that he did. And the Buddha says that all the source of our suffering is we're out of whack with reality. That's the problem. Reality exists one way, we think it exists in another, and we're behaving in the way that we think. And the result of it is unhappiness and suffering. And so this is, I think, you know, the meaning of this quote of Lama Yeshe's. Westerners should understand that taking refuge is a state of mind. So we're not relying upon what we, you know, the Buddha, some external person like, you know, other religions have of God or creator deity.
Please take away my problems.
Yeah, please take away my problems. Or the psychologist, please take away my problems. We're not doing that. You know, we can rely on the psychologist or the Buddhist teacher. They're helpful, but they explain to you what's going on. And then you have to make the changes. So, anything interesting about all this so far? So we'll come to the next little section, just these reasons for seeking refuge that we'll talk about. Is it really easy to understand? Do you guys, what does Geshe say? You get it?
It seems like when we're so overwhelmed by difficulties that we want refuge, but we're like just too panicked. Right, to help ourselves.
Yeah, okay, that's good, because this comes up in this next little section here. So there are sort of three times you can sort of take refuge. You know what? So one is before the problem. one is like way before you have the problem. The other is just as you sort of realize you've got a problem. And the other is you've got a problem. And it's like after the problem's happened and now you realize, oh, now I have to do
now
this.
Now I have a mess.
Yeah, now I have a mess and now I've got to get out of my mess. So they're the three sort of times. And the messes can be very small or they can be immensely huge. So let's have a look at the reasons for why a Buddhist takes refuge. So they take a refuge because they look at the big problem first. It's a massive problem. Yeah? And they're going to go, what am I going to do about that? Yeah. So as a preliminary to that, I'll just say a little thing here by quoting a verse that comes from Lama Tsongkhapa. And he says this, he says, leisure and opportunity are hard to find. And a lifespan leaves no time to waste. Reflect on this. And you'll counter the obsessions of a worldly life. Compulsive action and a reaction inexorably cause future cycles of pain. Repeatedly contemplate this. You'll counter obsession with an afterlife. So this verse sort of sums up what they call the four thoughts that turn the mind away from samsara and towards the Dhamma. So I'll just break it down. So the first one is called leisure and opportunity are hard to find. That is true, but you've got it already. It's hard to find, but if you're here, you've got it. And I have too. What it really means is that to have leisure means that you have the time to think about the material I'm talking. You are interested in a philosophical or religious spiritual path. And you have the opportunity to do so because you're human. So many living beings that are not human, they don't have the leisure or the opportunity to engage in a path, but we have. So that's number one. So in terms of all the living beings there are, that's incredibly rare. Incredibly rare. But we've got it. So that's the first thing. The second is, and a lifespan leaves no time to waste. So now we're talking about impermanence and death. So this first line, the one before, is leisure and opportunity are hard to find. From that we take appreciation. Appreciate what you've got. This life as a human being and the time you have to investigate this material. The second, and a lifespan leaves no time to waste, is to inspire within us a sense of urgency. Because we are disintegrating as we sit here. As soon as you're born, you're disintegrating, you're moving towards your own death. That's a certainty. There's no way we can escape that. But what's uncertain is when we'll die. So having the leisure and opportunity could come to an end at any time. In fact, we've had instances where I've actually taught on this, and the person's left home and had a road accident on the way home. They get it. Oh, I got it. I get it. Right? You get killed at any time. You could die any time. So that this topic inspires a sense of urgency. Now this one says, reflect on this. That's the topic of refuge. It's, you need to be safe. Safety. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? It's certain that death will overtake me, and I don't know when. How can I be safe? And this is the topic of refuge. The next one is, and if you do this, you will counter the obsessions of a worldly life. Right, so this is what we talk about, these eight worldly concerns, that we have this one life and we're just involved in the things. We seek to have pleasurable events and we seek to avoid displeasure. We want a good name, we don't want disrepute, all that stuff. Right? It says, the obsessions of a worldly life, compulsive action and reaction, inexorably caused. So that's the topic of karma. So the only person who can make any difference about karma is us. So that's the topic we call agency. It's up to us. If you want to be free from suffering, there's no one else who can do it but yourself. Want to be free? It's up to you. And lastly, it says compulsive actions and reactions, karma, agency, inexorably cause future cycles of pain. This form at samsara. But if you don't free yourself from the causes of suffering, you'll be overtaken by death and it'll happen again. It's like a compulsive birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, round and round and round. So right in the middle of that is this topic called refuge, because it's like, okay, what am I going to do about that? Because I don't know. I don't know what to do, and I don't, gee, how do I know? So that's where refuge comes in, this topic.
And so in a couple of weekends' time, Geshe Sherev is going to be teaching here in person on exactly that topic.
Oh.
Those four things. The four thoughts of turning the mind to
Dharma. Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
So a whole weekend on that with Geshe Sherev.
Which leads us into the slide here, right? The reasons for seeking refuge. So the first one is called the awareness of danger, faith or conviction that you can avoid that danger, and lastly, compassion. So it's compassion for ourselves and for others that go through this process. Faith means you are convinced that you can be free. Because if you couldn't be free, forget about it all. What can you do? But if you're certain of freedom, then we've got to have a shot at it, don't we? Otherwise, the same thing's just going to happen, and we'll always be dissatisfied. We'll always think, is this it? But to bring that about is a sense of something's got to impel us to do that. And that is, it's called danger. And the danger arises, they could call it a fear, alarm, and dread of what? Yes. And the answer is, what happens after death? What's going to happen to me? Because if I don't have any control over my life, I'm not going to have any control over my death.
Can it also be a fear or a dread of having just wasted this life?
Yeah, like that's right. Yeah, that's what you don't want to happen at the end of life. So there's this alarm or dread because, like I said, when we die, it's not the consciousness just stops. Right? That's the end of consciousness, that's the end of us, it's over. That's not what happens. So we're going to go, okay, so what might happen, we could ask. You say, well, it's either going to be very, very bad, or it could be pretty good. So all we have alarm and dread is if it's very, very bad. We do not want that. Yeah. So what I was going to use here, Sandy, as the example, was something just like that. So like I said before, you know, so you have, you have your refuge, it's like way before the problem starts, which is, this is what these classes are for, right? You're going to sort out so you don't have a problem later on. Right? It's like, get worried now so you don't worry later. The next part is like, my God, the terrible thing's going to happen and I'm right there. What am I going to do? Right? And the last one is, I'm in the problem. It's like, what do I do now? They're the three times. So here, in terms of the dread, fear, alarm is, I'm in the problem. And the example they gave was finding yourself in a mental institution. You've been going along, maybe you've been practicing too hard at the Dharma and you flip out. Right? And now you find yourself confined in a mental institution. What are you going to do? Now, if you're in a mental institution, it's very hard to get out. It's the same sort of thing, even though it's about future lives. If you find yourself in these terrible places, it's very, very hard to get out. Most times, the only way out is you have to die again. So when you're there, like, I'm sorry, it's sort of too late. You really don't have a refuge. Your only refuge is your next death, so you can get a complete change. The next thing is, like, suppose you recognize I'm going crazy. So now you have a chance now, don't you? You go, at least I recognize I'm going crazy. God, what can I do? I need some help. You know,
that's
you talk to somebody.
Asking for help.
You ask
really,
for,
really stressed before you break.
That's right. You get yourself down to the doctors and you get lots of help, right? The other one is way before the picture, you go, you know, it's possible to go crazy in life. Isn't it? Right? I'm going to make sure I don't go crazy. I'm going to make sure I don't push myself to extremes doing Dharma or anything else. I'm going to protect myself. So this is like this analogy of how you can take refuge. Way before, like now, just at the time, or a bit late sort of thing. So we sort of look at the big picture and we go, like I to be afraid of dying without control over your own mind, and having a mind, just, you should be afraid. And you should decide now, I'm not going to go to the mental institution of the lower realms. That's not going to happen to me. I know what I'd have to do to avoid it. I'm going to avoid it. So that's how we take this refuge. And you are like convinced that you can avoid going to a mental institution. You are convinced you will not go to the lower realms. at the end of death. You're convinced that there's a way to navigate the passage between this life and death. That you can do it. And this is all coming out of like, so these two first, fear and confidence, or having a sense of alarm, but also trust. That, yep, life is difficult, but I can avoid those difficulties. I'm convinced I can. I know what causes the difficulty, so I'm going to avoid them. And that's your refuge. And that is bringing towards yourself a sense of self-compassion, self-care. You care about your life. This life and other lives, because you know death is not the end. There's just a door opening, closing. You go in this one, just like going to sleep and waking up. You just wake up somewhere else and you'll be surprised. But this last one, you understand that this happens to everybody. We are all the same. So that means, so you take refuge now with this great compassion to go, I'm going to make sure that I liberate myself. I'm not going to mess my whole life up in the next life. Not only that, I'm going to help others do it too. When I find others who are afraid of dying, I'm going to talk to them. Try and put their mind at ease. If people are messing their lives up, as a parent, as a friend, I'm going to help them. I'm going to give them a sense of refuge. I'm going to be the refuge for others, as well as myself. So this is, so here we have this faith and compassion, or conviction and compassion. And this conviction, of course, is not blind conviction. It's not we have to believe it. We have to investigate it. We have to bring a sense of curiosity. Go into it like, I don't know. But then take that I don't know and challenge it. Go, well, what do I think I know? And then challenge that. So if we do this, refuge is going to change your life. It'll majorly change your life because you will know what causes suffering and what doesn't. And you will decide to not cause yourself any more suffering. That's what a genuine refugee is doing. And by doing that, it stops you causing others suffering. So what it does, it brings you a great sense of relief. Wouldn't you feel relieved if you knew all your suffering could be overcome? So you know what to abandon, you know what to adopt, and you've tamed your mind.
So is that like going from just hoping that instead of the worldly things where we hope there are refuge that's going to work and yeah. Our hopes are constantly dashed to actually knowing what to do and what not to do, that gives you, is that what gives a sense of confidence?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, not just that, but through the reasoning, through thinking it through clearly, and then try to knock your reasoning down. And go, okay, that's all, you know, great reasoning. But has anybody else done it? Now, especially this term of like these afterlives and deaths, you want to read about the great practitioners who have such a great control over their mind that even when they declare dead, like they're there. And that's all because they've been able to tame their mind. Now, the sense of refuge changes over time as you get deeper into your practice. So we begin by saying that after death doesn't just stop us. That after death, be a terrible rebirth or a good rebirth. We want the good rebirth. We want to be born at least again as human beings who can engage again in their spiritual path. So my teacher, Khinsa Rinpoche, said, if after death you find that you have not been born as a human being, you've wasted your life. So, oh, I've never forgotten that one. Yeah. That's right. What's the point of listing all this stuff and then saying, you know, you've got a leader? Well, I know myself, I won't be enlightened. It's not likely I'll be liberated either. But boy, I don't want to find myself. I would like to be reborn as a human being who can engage again in this path, meet it again, and keep going. If you don't get that, consider what you've done as a waste of time. You've lost it. So we don't want that to happen to us. We want to be able to, you know, that's what we're seeking. Enlightenment, liberation, higher rebirth. The second one is liberation. We want to go beyond these higher rebirths because it's always suffering. Here we are. We've already got a higher rebirth. We're human. We're here. It's difficult. It's not an easy thing to be a human being. I'm sure everyone knows this. What do you want? Freedom. There's the second, the refuge leads to freedom. And lastly, it's like, how about I could help everybody else become free from suffering too? What if I could become like a Buddha? Like the Buddha taught this means of freedom. I want to be that sort of like, or woman. Now, when it comes to explaining this refuge to others, so this is this last one about the Christian asking you. So I want to point out a few things too, where there's great similarities between Christianity and Buddhism. There's also differences, but here's some similarities, right? So in Christianity, your refuge figure is God, Christ, the saints, or the angels, right? That's what you take refuge in. In terms of the Dharma or the teachings, you take refuge in the teachings, Bible, and the scholars, I guess, and the priests and so forth. And what are you to do? Develop faith in this, to develop love in particular, and to abandon sin. And if you don't do what the Bible says and what God has, the message has been, what's going to happen? You go to hell, don't you? And if you do what they say, you go to heaven. And sometimes you find yourself right in this middle ground called purgatory. In Buddhism, we're taking refuge in Buddha, they call it Dharmakaya. So these terms here, you won't know what they mean, but we'll come to that later on. But this is what we take refuge in. Shakyamuni Buddha, the example. The bodhisattvas, the deities, the protectors and so forth. And what's our Dharma? The tantras, the sutras, the commentaries, scriptures, but most important, realization. So with the Bible, it's really like it's a faith. Oh, well, sorry, with the thing, it's like faith, isn't it?
So it's an external.
It's an external object you're relying on, and the faith is in that. Buddha does have internal faith, internal conviction in what you're doing, and it only comes about through investigation and analysis. So you know, I got it. How do they do it? Using what they call skillful means, compassion, the mind of enlightenment and wisdom. What are they seeking as Buddhists? Well, enlightenment, liberation, or freedom from these realms of samsara. Otherwise, we'll find ourselves in the realms of samsara. So we're already in a realm of samsara now, but we're in the best realm, human beings with intelligence, understanding. And through the study of the Buddha Dharma, we have a method.
My auntie, who's a Christian, says, so I'm a little worried if you're going to go to hell because you're a Buddhist. What would I say to her?
Well, what would you say? You could say something like, don't worry, Mum, I found the right path for me. God understands. God is love, He understands. Now, this is one of the great Muslim philosopher poets said this. His name was Hafiz. He said, I wish I could show you when you are lonely or in darkness, the astonishing light of your own being. Now that's possible through a Buddhist path. Hafiz, who's a believer in Muslims and his refuge is Allah, discovered it himself. The Christians discover it through love. So this is always what we call this like the Buddha nature. It's just the nature of the mind. That's all it is. And we all have a mind, but we just haven't discovered this astonishing light. But the path leads you to that. So that brings us to the end of our course tonight. So I hope you have found something of interest. There's a number of things you find interesting. You might ask yourself these questions of why you find it interesting, what does it remind you of, or what is it so different from, and why that's important to you. Now, just so thank you for being here, staying awake, listening, thinking. So what's your takeaway? Well, you know that this sense of refuge is a foundation and entrance to all the Buddhist practice and teachings. And lastly, it marks the distinction between what's a Buddhist and what's not a Buddhist. So you don't have to become a Buddhist, of course, to practice Buddhist teachings. You can remain exactly as you are. And you could be a Buddhist, a Christian or a Muslim, makes no difference. You can take what's useful. So up online, we have some material there. You can have a look at. So on pages 10 and 19, 44 to 48, there's the FPMT notes. And there's what's called Class Notes 1, excerpts. And next week, we're going to look at these objects of refuge, what Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is. There's a number of different explanations. There's in terms of inner Buddha, outer Buddha, what the Pali tradition thinks is Buddha, what the Mahayana tradition thinks is Buddha, and so forth. So I hope you will be here. I hope it's interesting enough and you wish to know more. So we spent 1.5 hours here. We spent energy sitting, listening, thinking. So I want to take that energy, which is called merit. We call it merit, and dedicate it towards the original goal that you had for yourself. So whatever reason you came here for, may whatever you've done lead to the accomplishment of that goal, but may it also increase your love and your compassion and your skill in dealing with yourself and others. So if you like, you can recite along with me. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. And this next prayer is like sort of saying, may that wish never decrease, but only increase. May the supreme dual bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space endures, as long as sentient beings abide, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. Okay. Thank you very much, and have a good night.